This year saw the centenary of the death of the great Russian novelist Leo Tolstoy, a man who wrote works of fiction with considerable philosophical depth. In fact, he thought that his most famous book, War and Peace, was not a novel at all, but an examination of social and political ideas. So, in our final Philosopher's Zone for 2010, we're returning to a popular program we made earlier this year on Russian philosophical thinking, mostly in the 19th and early 20th centuries. Hi, I'm Alan Saunders, and you're listening to the overture from Mikhail Glinka's nationalistic opera, A Life for the Tsar, which premiered in St. Petersburg in 1836. Now, to help us with our journey to Russia, we're joined by Leslie Chamberlain. Leslie is the author of Motherland, A Philosophical History of Russia. And she also wrote The Philosophy Steamer, which is about the exile of a group of anti-Bolshevik Russian intellectuals in 1922. And when she joined us from London, we began with Tolstoy. He was said to have been aligned with a radical anarcho-pacifist Christian philosophy, which led to his excommunication from the Russian Orthodox Church in 1901. How does he fit into the definition of what philosophy is in Russia?
Well, I think the Russians have always been absolutely dedicated to using philosophy to find the right way to live, rather than, how you might see it in the West, as an instrument, an intellectual instrument, in pursuit of truth. And that produces a very different kind of atmosphere and a different vocabulary and in the end, perhaps some different questions. The Russians have always distinguished between what they call two kinds of truth. One of them has the name Pravda, like the old newspaper, and the other one has the name Istina. And Istina is basically the truth of the natural sciences, whereas Pravda is an emotional or moral truth, and that's the one that Russian philosophy is after, and that's what makes it rather different from Western philosophy, I think.
Does this work both ways? I mean, in general, can we say that Russian literature is more philosophical than the literature of other cultures?
Yes, certainly more philosophical than say, English literature or even French. I think German is quite philosophical. But Russian is philosophical in this special way that it keeps repeating the quest for how to live. And I think that has a lot to do with the circumstances of Russian society under the Tsars, under the autocracy. That is, there wasn't freedom of speech. It was also a society in which the law gave people no reason to trust it or no kind of stability or a strong sense of the form of the right kind of society. And I think literature took on the role of discussing those things that couldn't be discussed directly. So it was a response to censorship. And also, there was an attempt to give the moral law where there wasn't the law in society. The philosophical tradition, as a practice, as an academic practice, started really quite late, the beginning of the 19th century. And that was easy for the political authorities to put pressure on, and often, you know, they closed down the departments when they didn't like what they were doing. So literature was a way of both reaching a much wider audience and talking about ideas in a slightly camouflaged way. And I think this encouraged a very different kind of general feeling in culture that literature was philosophically responsible. It was about this quest for the right way to live, and that's very clear from Russian literature, I think.
Now, you've mentioned the particular sort of truth in which philosophical thinking in Russia is interested, the emotional rather than the scientific truth. Mm-hmm. Is that what gives Russian philosophy its particular bent, its particular focus, or are there other features that would characterise it?
No, I think it's this search for what I would call an ethical foundation for being, and that in tandem with a definition of what this Russian truth is, what this specific Russian contribution should be to the ethical life of mankind. I mean, when you come to Dostoevsky, you find that when he's pursuing these questions, he thinks that if he can answer that question for the Russian person, then he can answer it for the whole of humanity. I mean, that's obviously very contestable, but it's the high point of a certain quest in Russian philosophy.
There seems to have been a certain aversion to reason here. I mean, it seems odd to refer, I don't know whether people do refer, but it seems to me odd to refer, say, to a Russian Enlightenment.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, I think when historically it's possible to refer to Russian Enlightenment, Catherine the Great corresponding with Diderot, the editor of the French Encyclopédie, which is the kind of cornerstone of the French Enlightenment. But all that was philosophically quite superficial. And I suppose one could take the career, the life of a particular late 18th century thinker called Alexander Radishchev as a guide to the Russian Enlightenment. Now, Radishchev was very interested in the American Revolution, and he was very interested in the abolition of slavery, the proposals for the abolition of slavery. Very progressive thinker, and he turned his attention to Russia, and he made a famous journey from St. Petersburg to Moscow, and he published, it's a kind of novel, but it contains reflections on Russian injustice and on the serfdom. And for that, he was put in prison, and he very narrowly escaped with his life. And Catherine the Great took a personal interest in this. But the man was destroyed by what happened to him. And so his experience is a complete opposite of what one think of as the Enlightenment. Your question, however, about philosophy and about its kind of Russian aversion to reason is a slightly different one, insofar as I think the Russian tendency with its quest for the right way to live was always at least subliminally religious and sometimes overtly religious. And as someone, a philosopher, said at the turn of the 20th century, that really Russian philosophy, the figurehead from, let's say, the 17th century, was Pascal rather than Descartes. So Descartes is for us in the West is the father of modern philosophy, the scientific revolution, whereas Pascal is really his opposite. He's talking about the relationship to God and belief. So the Russians very much are with Pascal, if you make that kind of distinction.
Well, that's interesting. Descartes, he didn't exactly invent scepticism. It had been around for a couple of thousand years before him, but he more or less encapsulates a particularly modern way of being sceptical about the world and about the information that your senses can give you of the world. And his questions are recurrent questions to this day in Western philosophy. Are there similarly recurrent questions in Russian philosophy?
No, I don't think Russian philosophy is inclined to turn its searchlight on the questioning subject. I mean, Descartes made us as individual seekers after truth very self-conscious and gave us a kind of conscience that we should always, as it were, double-check our results, doubt the premises that we're working on, doubt the truths that we think we've discovered, in order always to bring in this self-scrutiny. I mean, the last person to pass judgment on truth, as it were, is you. You have to have a refined conscience and self-scrutiny in the pursuit of truth. Now, there's nothing like that in Russia. It's very, I would say, non-individualistic in Russia, whereas Descartes has helped to contribute to a very individualistic Western culture. I mean, you get philosophers who declare openly that the truth is a collective truth. It's something that we all are part of and contribute to. So it's a very different way.
You mentioned Pascal, but you say at one point of the book that for better, for worse, this Platonic Pascalian inheritance was the face of modern Russia. That's talking of somebody writing in the early years of the 20th century. So Plato obviously is potentially an important link here with the Western philosophical tradition.
Yes, not so much a direct influence, in fact, hardly at all, but a very interesting analogy insofar as Plato was interested in defining the good man and the good society. Where the Russians don't follow the Western way with Plato is they don't seem to be interested in Socrates and the Socratic method. And that makes for two very different ways of philosophizing. I have to say that the Russian way leads almost inevitably towards ideology. I mean, some people feel that Plato is very ideological on his on the side of pursuing the good society, and that's where the Russian affinity fits. So one might have sense that all of Russian philosophy is a kind of moral philosophy with a kind of particular moral take on politics, which is included in that. I mean, we haven't mentioned this yet, and surely we should, that the huge drive of Russian intellectual life in the 19th century was to reform that cruel and backward society, and philosophy had its job cut out there.
You've mentioned the idea of the good man. Do we find that a search for that character in the writings of a notable liberal and rather westernized figure of the 19th century, Alexander Herzen?
I think we do, but in a rather different form, because as you say, Herzen was quite a westernized figure. I mean, in Russia, he was regarded as the quintessential westernizer as opposed to a Slavophile. Now, these two tendencies, they overlapped quite a lot. They were very alive in Russian cultural life from about the end of the 1820s through to the time of Dostoevsky in the 1880s. And the westernizers really wanted to borrow Western models to further the progress of Russian society. And the Slavophiles were much more insistent on returning to Russian roots, and in particular to the roots of the Orthodox Church. But I think what makes Herzen a very special and in a way exemplary character in himself is that he was an individualist. He spoke up for the individual human person. And strange as this may seem, it's not a very conspicuous trait in Russian philosophy to dwell on the individual person. And that, I think, is not a good thing about Russian philosophy. Personally, I find it too communal and not individualistic enough.
Let's take a brief look at the philosopher Nikolai Berdyaev, who lived from 1874 to 1948, and whose life in some way reflects the sweep of modern Russian history. He was an aristocrat by birth, interested in Marxism at university, but also an Orthodox Christian, and he was sent to Central Russia for a few years for his political activities. Because he was opposed to Bolshevism, he ended up being exiled in 1922 on what became known as the Philosophy Steamer. Now, you've done a lot of work on this moment in history in which a boatload of intellectuals went into exile. I presume it's been called the Philosophy Steamer not because all the people on board were professional or formal philosophers, but because they all in some way embodied philosophical thinking.
Well, talk about Nicholas Berdyaev first. He was perhaps the foremost philosopher before the revolution in what I'll call the idealist tradition. That is, he believed in a transcendental authority for the right way to live. So he was somebody who took his authority from mysticism and from religion. That said, he wrote very appealing and practical sounding books about how to lead the good life, and he found a very willing public, I think, in the time when the revolution was preparing to happen in Russia. So there were these extremes of political revolution and in a way spiritual revolution, and Berdyaev stood for the spiritual revolution of Russia before 1917. Why he was exiled is, I suppose, obvious. Lenin regarded him as one of his principal opponents, his principal opponent on paper, as it were, as a thinker. And the 69 so-called philosophers who were exiled and their families on two ships, in fact, which are collectively called the Philosophy Steamer, were all in some way ideological opponents of Lenin. Many of them actually handpicked by Lenin himself. And Lenin's definition of those whom he exiled on the Philosophy Steamer was people, mostly men, who just would never come round to the Bolshevik way of thinking. And from Lenin's side, it was a merciful gesture, really, that these people simply wouldn't be able to live in Soviet Russia, and they would probably perish. And there were 69 of these specially chosen exiles. Of those, in fact, only 9 or 10 were philosophers. There were just as many economists, and I think that's very interesting. And if I came back to the subject, if I wrote my book again, I think I might even emphasize that. They were ideological opponents from various quarters, people who didn't think the communist economy would work, people who didn't believe in the materialist philosophy. There were cooperatists who saw a different way of establishing a kind of more commonly minded economy. There were independent publishers who also, you know, they were anathema for the new centralized state, which would control book publishing and so on.
Talking about Lenin, you are in your book very rude about Lenin's forays into philosophy, about which he did write. What did he do and where did he go wrong?
I don't think Lenin himself believed he was a philosopher. And there's this huge book, 400 pages, of materialism and empirio-criticism. Lenin sat down in the British Museum, in the round reading room, and worked like mad for about 9 months to put together all the points of view in philosophy that he didn't agree with. And then he tried to work up a way in which he would dismiss them, and he was terribly rude in the way he wrote about them. And you know, if you can't argue against something, then just hurl abuse at it. That was very much the principle that he was following in that book. But what is interesting is what he was trying to get rid of. He was trying massively to simplify philosophy and present it to this new country, the Soviet Union, which he wanted to give, above all, a principle of order to Russian life, to Soviet Russian life as it would become. And I think that is, in fact, a way in which one can come back and see Lenin with a degree of sympathy, because this was such a chaotic country, such a difficult country to kind of harness and make culturally and politically productive. So Lenin decided that anything that was subjective in philosophy, anything that allowed people to consult their own conscience and consciousness as a definition of reality, was absolutely unsuitable for the world he was trying to create. So he dismissed all the philosophers who said that truth is a matter of self-scrutiny. He said that the objective world out there exists objectively, and really, if you can't see it and agree with it, then there's something wrong with you. And it's as crude as that. And I think that if I was rude about it, that's why I was rude about it.
At the end of your book, there is a comparative chronology of Russian and Western philosophers. And the last Russian figure you mention is Alexander Solzhenitsyn. So even here, there is a pull towards the literary. But confining ourselves to more or less formal philosophers, who, over the last two centuries, would you say have been the most influential or the most interesting figures?
I think that's a very difficult question to answer. And I think that a philosopher and writer whose influence never goes away is Dostoevsky. There is this constant fascination both in Russia and in the West. And so many of the ideas in the 19th century and the 20th century can be seen as foundations for Dostoevsky to build on, or developments that have been made by other philosophers from Dostoevsky. Because in Dostoevsky, you have this preoccupation with a Russian truth, you have the Russian spirituality, and you have certain xenophobic tendencies, certain excesses, which seem to come with the Russian philosophical tradition, at the same time as you do have the desire for the good man and the good society. There is a philosopher I admire very much called Peter Lavrov, who was more or less Dostoevsky's contemporary. And we don't hear very much about him because he was a little bit too close to 19th century philosophers whom Lenin did like. Lenin didn't like Lavrov because he was one of these, in a way, individualists, but he was very attuned to Russian circumstances. And he stressed above all that perennial theme in Russian literature and Russian thought of we must make a better society. How can we reform this society? And I think that can never be stressed too much. And what Lavrov did in the 1860s was to write a series of philosophical letters in which he tried to show that there was an ethical imperative for the educated man to devote his life to the reform of Russia. Now, I don't think he tried to do a job rather like Kant. He tried to say that if you were born into fortunate circumstances, you had no alternative if you wanted to be a good man but to work for the reform of your country. That ethical imperative, I mean, it doesn't somehow exist out there without question, but it does describe what he felt was the good life. And I think that many people even today would think that he'd got that right. So I think he's an important figure, Peter Lavrov.
To return to Tolstoy, he came to believe in ascetic renunciation. Where does he get the idea? Can we see here the influence of another German philosopher, Arthur Schopenhauer, or of Christian, Buddhist, Hindu ideas?
Yes, I think in a general sense, although, I mean, on other occasions he was terribly rude about Schopenhauer. Schopenhauer, who assembled quite a good case for suicide. I mean, Schopenhauer was a Western pessimist, and Tolstoy was absolutely against that. He felt that the most natural impulse in human beings was to live, and he couldn't countenance either the morality or the impulse to suicide. So if he was influenced by Schopenhauer in this particular way of renunciation, then that was a very sort of specific borrowing. I think that, above all, Tolstoy was constantly wrestling with his own conscience and his own impulses. There is this sense that he was trying to dampen down the life force in himself, and that tied in with some reading in asceticism and Christian renunciation, which he did very strongly approve of and advocate.
And this aspect of his thought seems in turn to have influenced both Mahatma Gandhi and the development of Russian anarchist thought.
Yes, although I think it influenced individuals. But from my point of view, Tolstoy was always something of an exception in the Russian tradition. And for us in the Anglo-Saxon world, he was a way into Russia because he held certain values and certain views, like a kind of Christian renunciation of violence, of retaliation, an asceticism, a turning away from the sort of wickedness of urban life into the goodness of the countryside. All this had quite a strong appeal, I think, certainly in England at the end of the 19th century. And so it became very convenient to see Tolstoy as the face of Russia, of a spiritual Russia. But in fact, I mean, there was always Dostoevsky as the other face of Russia. And it's in fact Dostoevsky who much more determines the actual philosophical tradition. Tolstoy is something of an exception. He is a very Russian figure, but he doesn't represent the 19th century, at least not as I understand it.
Well, for details of Leslie's work on the history of Russian philosophy, hit our website, abc.net.au/rn/philosopherszone. And that's also the place to make comments about the show. Leslie Chamberlain, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure.
The Philosopher's Zone is produced each week by Kyla Slavin and Charlie McCune. And I'm Alan Saunders. Do svidaniya.